This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your guest host, Tom Perry, and tonight we're going to be talking about a subject that's very close and near and dear to my heart, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And tonight, I'm very privileged and honored to have on the show with us tonight Dr. Gene Sessions. How you doing tonight, Professor?
Doing very well, Tom. And please just call me Gene.
All right, we'll go with Gene. Appreciate that. Just as a background, Gene Sessions was born in Ogden, Utah. He received his BA from Utah State University and his PhD from FSU. And he's an author and editor of numerous books, including Mormon Thunder, a documentary history of Jedediah Morgan Grant, and Camp Floyd and the Mormons, the Utah War, Latter-day Patriots, Prophesying Upon the Bones, J. Reuben Clark and the Foreign Debt Crisis, and many others. He's also been on some documentaries talking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre, like Burying the Past, The Legacy of the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 2004. And he's also been a past president of the Mountain Meadows Association starting in 1998. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So you've got quite the history with the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
I think it's maybe a little more involved than some. I might mention that my book on Camp Floyd, which I finished for a deceased colleague, Camp Floyd and the Mormons, has a lengthy chapter on the massacre, which was kind of how I got involved in it to start with on the academic side. And then I came onto the board of the Mountain Meadows Association in 98 and was involved kind of on the ground floor of all that activity that happened with the new monument in 99 and the digging up of the bones and all that kind of thing. And so if you wanted to tonight, we might get a little bit into that story in addition to the actual massacre and what its meaning is.
Yeah, that might be good because you are actually intimately there. I mean, weren't you? You were actually part of it.
Yeah, I held some of the remains in my hands, and it's something that sends chill up and down my back to this day.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if that's a privilege or something that might haunt you.
it's a bit of a burden, actually, but something that I had to do, and I was involved very directly at that time. I was president of the association a little bit after that. You mentioned beginning of 98, I was just on the board from 98 to 2005, I think I retired from the board. I was president for about a year and a half, I don't remember the years, 2002 or 3, something like that. It was a great opportunity because I got to know so many people on both sides. I don't have any ancestors involved on either side myself, but I got to know folks from Arkansas and others connected to the Arkansas people, and also people here in the Lee family and other people on the murderer's side. And it was a very interesting experience to be able to travel to Arkansas and have them come here. And I developed some very dear friendships. I'm kind of a huggy, can't wait to see you next friend with Patty Norris, who's the great-great-granddaughter of Trophenia Fancher Wilson, who was only 11 months old when the massacre happened and was, of course, rescued by the Army in 1859 and repatriated to Arkansas. So it's been a blessing in a lot of ways, but in other ways, you mentioned, it's not something that I wrote a book review for this book by Rick Turley and Ron Walker and Glenn Leonard for the Overland Journal. At the end, I said, this is a story that unfortunately has no end. And when you find out about it, it has a life of its own, and it really doesn't have an end. And that's unfortunate.
But you should be commended for reaching out to some of the descendants like you are. I think that's a very strong step in trying to heal some of these very, very sore wounds.
And, you know, I might mention, Tom, that the current church historian, Marlon Jensen, who's from up in my neck of the woods here in Weber County, has done a magnificent job of dealing with these various ancestor groups. And when I was involved, there was just the Mountain Meadows Association and an organization called the Mountain Meadows Monument Foundation. Now there's another group available only to descendants of the victims. I'm an honorary board member of that because I'm not a descendant of the victims, but I can tell you last summer, having attended a couple of meetings and talked with a number of my friends in two of those organizations, including Patty and Terry Fancher, the president of the Mountain Meadows Association today, that they think Marlin has just done an incredible job of working with them, making them feel better about where the church is, particularly with regard to their desire to have the site declared a national historic landmark. And Marlin is working very hard to see that that happens, and that's made them very pleased. Last summer they had an anniversary of the 150th anniversary of the repatriation of the children, and they met at the Meadows and had quite a ceremony, and the church paid for everything, paid for the food, set up a big pavilion for them to have their meeting there, a PA system, and they're grateful for this. And I don't think, I'm not trying to tell you that these folks are about to become Mormons, so, even though a handful have, surprisingly. We have victim descendants who are Mormons, but their feelings of distrust and bitterness toward the church have abated considerably, even since the days when President Hinckley was reaching out to them back at the end of the 90s. I think Marlin deserves a lot of credit for that, and I think the feelings, in fact, I know, I've had these folks tell me that their feelings toward Utah and toward the church are much more positive now than they've ever been. So I think right now, with the 150th anniversaries kind of sliding away now in memory, there was the one in 2007 of the 150th anniversary of the massacre itself, and then this one about the repatriation of the children. They're still active. The groups still want this National Historic Landmark status. The church has purchased recently at a great expense a large parcel on the north end, just before you cross the highway on your way north out of the meadow, where we think there are two or three more graves, and have promised to protect those. And so some of the descendants, Scott Fancher, who was the past president of the Mountain Meadows Monument Foundation, loves to say, well, having the Mormon Church own these grave sites is like having the family of Lee Harvey Oswald looking after the grave of President Kennedy. And so there are some people who aren't real happy about that, but sure. The church happens to own all that property and where the graves are. And I don't think we're going to see anytime soon the church say, well, you know what, we'll give that up to the government or and so on. And Hinckley promised in the dedication ceremony in 99 that the church would take care of that property and work with the descendants to make sure they were happy with how it was being taken care of. So I'm not telling you everybody's, you know, jumping up and down with happiness over the church's involvement, but I am saying that right now my sense is that the feelings among the victims' families are much better than they've ever been, thanks to what the church has tried to do, and particularly Marlin Jensen.
Yeah, I completely agree. So before we keep going on, I did want to also mention that you're a current professor at Weber State University. Is that still correct?
I've been at Weber State for 35 years. I'm getting pretty old, but I'm sure having a good time, and it's been a great life. And
you're still chair
history right now. So, no, I'm not chair any longer. I spent 6 years as chair and found out I'm not very good at that sort of thing. So I'm back to the classroom now and loving my full-time teaching again. I'm teaching Utah history, as a matter of fact. And this week and next, we're dealing with the Utah War and the massacre in that class. And very important for students being educated to teach Utah history, whether fourth grade, seventh grade here in the state, where that's required with kids, that they know the brutal facts, they know what happened, and so they're able to deal with that however they can. And in fourth grade, they don't mess with it too much, obviously, but in the seventh grade, they do. And So we in the state who teach Utah history on a college level work very hard to try to make sure that the story of the massacre is well told and well understood.
Well, I, for one, am very, very, very pleased to hear that. I mean, just as a side note, do you come across a lot of people or students that have no idea about any of it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, I think I know where you're going, and I'll tell you just real quickly my own story. I was told by seminary teachers and so on that it didn't happen, or that it was the Indians and the Mormons got a bum rap and they didn't do it and so on like that. And it wasn't until after I had gotten well into my college career that I found out about it. And back in those days, it was still pretty hush-hush. Now it's all kind of out on the table. I mean, we've got all these books by Denton and Bagley and these three Mormon historians I mentioned, and there's been a lot of attention with the sesquicentennial's passing. Been a lot of attention in the paper and national press. Books like John Krakauer's Under the Banner of Heaven, two chapters on the massacre there. And as we ran up to the Olympics, all the news magazines like New Yorker and Newsweek, from you know, hoi polloi down to the common news magazines, ran articles on Utah, and all of them talked about the massacre, and some of them in some ways that weren't terribly accurate or flattering. So it's out big time now, unlike it was when I was a kid, and I don't know how old you are, but it's sure out a lot more now, and that's good.
Yeah, I'm 35 now, and I didn't learn. I mean, I guess I'd heard about it in passing, but I didn't know about it until I was 32. And
I don't think that's unusual, Tom. I really don't. Unusual at all.
I still feel unusual, but but when it hit me, yeah, it hit me right in the face, and I became semi-obsessed with it. We're trying to read everything I could about it, so
I have my best friend at Weber State is a business professor who was serving as an elders quorum president at the age of 40, and this is some 25 years ago now, and he found out about it, and that brought him right out of the back door of the church. He's now not a member of the church, and that was what got him confused and worried.
But you're still friends with him, is that right?
Oh, we're best friends.
Great.
We're just as close as brothers, maybe closer.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
All right. So let's.
Well, his thing. I mean, not to talk too much about him, but his thing is I tease him that he's the best Mormon I know, and his hell is going to be going to the celestial kingdom.
That'll be his hell.
That'll be his hell. Yeah.
That's great.
Because he'll have to rub shoulders with all these people he doesn't like. But we're closer than brothers. And we talk a lot about these issues. And in fact, he has accompanied me on some of my excursions to meet with descendants. In fact, he went with me to the BYU archaeology offices 2 days after the bones came up, and he's held them in his hand as well. So we're just across the line from each other on what we do about the church. But that's what got him upset, and I know that's the case with a lot of folks, and maybe we can talk a little bit later if you want to about why I don't think that's a great idea for people to let this bother them that way.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
I'm a historian, and I can deal with it in all kinds of ways, but
I'm sure you've got some invaluable advice for people like that.
Well, that's up to you. I mean, whatever you want to do tonight, but if you want, we can talk a little bit about that.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started. For some of those that, unfortunately, I guess are probably not too aware about the Mount Meadows Massacre, or just have heard the name and don't really know what's going on with it, let's kind of paint a picture of what was happening in Utah in the early fall of 1857.
Okay, I kind of knew you wanted me to do that, so I've been trying to figure out how to do it in 5 minutes. It's pretty hard call, but basically it occurred during the Utah War episode, better known to a lot of Mormons as the Johnston's Army episode, when President Buchanan sent the federal army here to install a new governor and to replace Brigham Young as governor. And he had reason to believe that he might meet resistance from the Mormons, and so sent the governor with an accompanying military force. And it was the biggest military force operating in the United States at the time. And 2,500, 3,000 soldiers marching on Utah through the summer and fall of 1857. Well, an early winter and a Mormon resistance, the famous Echo Canyon War, where Brigham Young sent the Mormons up into the mountains and up into Wyoming to harass the army with orders not to hurt anybody, but to burn wagons, shoot mules, etc., combined to keep the army out until a deal was worked out in the spring of 58, and the army came on in and occupied Utah for the next two, three years till the Civil War came, and everybody went off to kill each other back east. And they built Camp Floyd out in the Cedar Valley west of Utah Lake, and were there during that period of time. Well, during that summer, while the army was on its way, of course, there were ordinary westward moving migrants, overlanders, several parties of them, and some of them chose to miss Utah altogether as they found out about this problem that was developing. Some decided to come on through Utah. There was a party from northwest Arkansas, and it had gathered up some other folks along the way that decided to come on in and go down the Mormon corridor, what we now think of as the I-15 corridor. This party had a number of families. It also had a number of cattle. There's a debate about how many cattle there were, but most historians think that was a significant part of the problem that occurred. As they went down the corridor toward Cedar, which was the last outpost the Mormons had left in place, everybody else had been called back from San Bernardino and Carson Valley and so on under this siege situation that was going on. On the way down there, problems between this Arkansas party and Mormons particularly, and also the Indians. And Brigham Young, who was the Indian agent, had been trying to keep the Indians from attacking the immigrants over the years, and he called all the sub-chiefs in and said, "Hey, all bets are off. We're at war with these people, and you can do what you want." Anyway, on the way down, a number of incidents occur. There's debate about exactly what happened, although looking at contemporary sources, we're now sure that there were some rather serious confrontations between Mormons and these immigrants over particularly their cattle, who were tromping out through the winter fields and this and that. There was a cow died, and some Indians ate it, and maybe some of them died, got sick, so they were accused of poisoning this cow. Anyway, long story made short, if we can, they got down to Cedar City. Word had gone ahead of them that they were aggressive and they were troublemakers and there had been problems. And at Cedar, while they were there, some incidents occurred. We won't have time to get deeply into all that. The Mormons decided, the stake president there, a fellow called Isaac Haight, and the local leadership decided that these people needed to be quote-unquote punished for the things they had done up and down the corridor and there in Iron County. Well, the plan was that John D. Lee, who had contact with the Paiutes, would go out and rouse them up and get them to attack this party. We now think the attack was supposed to happen down on Santa Clara, where the Mogotsu Creek and the Spanish Trail comes down onto the Santa Clara. But anyway, one thing led to another, and there begins to be fighting out there. And during the week of September 6th through the 11th, 1857, the Mormon militia, the Nauvoo Legion, begins to migrate out there. 50, 60 guys eventually are out there. And one thing leads to another. They're convinced that these folks know they're involved in this supposed Indian attack that's kind of gone bad on them. The Paiutes don't have much stomach for it. They're not armed well. They've got cattle. They are starting to disappear. And so I'm really oversimplifying this. I mean, there's plenty more going on, but I'm trying
to. Of course, yeah, that's all right.
On Thursday and Friday, September 10th and September 11th, 1857, the Mormon militia, these militiamen, decide, with some collusion back to Cedar and to the Parowan commander of the Nauvoo Legion, William Dame, who's been kind of involved on the periphery to this moment, that these people have got to be killed because they know too much, and if they go on to California, there's going to be big trouble, and so on and so on. The afternoon of September 11th, they're lured out of their wagon circle where they've been putting up a heck of a fight against the Indians and the Mormons, of course, now mostly the Mormons. And were systematically murdered. About 120 folks, mostly women and kids. The order was that everyone was to be killed old enough to tell the tale, quote unquote. Mormon theology suggested that you could not be forgiven for shedding innocent blood under any circumstance, and so the idea was, well, the kids who are 8 and under will be saved, or under the age of 8 will be saved. As it turns out, they saved 17 kids. The oldest one was 6 years and 11 months old. Everyone else was murdered. And there's no question that the Mormons, that we've known for a long, long time, going way back into the 20th century, that from evidence that was extant from trials and other testimonies, that the Mormons did most of the killing and indeed administered coup de grace to folks who'd been wounded, women, kids, and men. The folks in Arkansas, just to kind of put a footnote on this, they can be very kindly disposed toward Utah and toward Mormons, but they really bristle up and get red in the eye when they have to think about the cowardly act of that afternoon when these folks were lured out under white flags and then murdered.
Can't say I blame them.
No, I can't blame them either, and there's just absolutely no excuse for it. This has been all kinds of thought over the years by all kinds of people about why this happened. There are theories that Brigham Young ordered these people killed. Will Bagley's theory is that they were ordered murdered to get revenge for the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith, and then the killing in May of that year of Parley P. Pratt in Arkansas. Bagley's thesis in his book Blood of the Prophets is that this was the reason they were murdered, and that as he puts it, they were dead as soon as they entered Utah territory. Other theories are put out in the 1970s by a fellow called William Wise, and then repeated by Sally Denton in her book in the early part of this century, when the decade ended or not yet. That it was done for their wealth. There was some evidence that came forth after the massacre that there was a lot of money in the train. People back home said, oh yeah, my cousin or my sister had X amount of gold, and that Brigham Young ordered them, when he found out how wealthy they were, ordered them murdered for their money. And I'll tell you that most folks in Arkansas subscribe to that theory, even the most kindly of them. I believe that it was ordered. They were ordered killed for their money. The consensus of most historians follows a little more closely what you find in this book by the three Mormon scholars who spent $1 million over the last 5-6 years to write their book, Massacre at Mountain Meadows. That's Walker, Turley, and Leonard. That what this really was a combination of bad decision-making on the part of all kinds of people, particularly the local leaders down that way, the dangers of the militia tradition, the prevalence of violence and violent language and violent propensities in the West.
Some paranoia.
War hysteria, paranoia, all kinds of issues like that that kind of combine to... And then a lot of bad assumptions that were made during that week, during the siege. So the debate will go on and on and on about why it happened. We know pretty much what happened. I don't think there's much question now with all this research and all this writing that we can't sit back and say, oh, here's what happened. But there are a lot of folks who want to say, well, this is proof that Mormonism is evil. It was evil then, and it's violent. This is Krakauer's thesis, of course, in his book
right.
About the Laffertys. It's proof that Brigham Young was a bad person, and he ordered these people murdered, and so on like that. The trouble with those conspiracy theories, in my view, and this is just my opinion, having looked into this pretty deeply over the years, the trouble with those conspiracy theories is that if you buy one of them, then everything else we know about what happened in Utah with regard to that company and its tragic, atrocious demise, it doesn't make any sense. You don't have to defend Brigham Young. You just have to look at what happened. And if it was a conspiracy to have them murdered from the time, as Will says, the time they entered the state, they were dead, then all the rest of what happened down the way makes no sense. And we've got enormous amounts of evidence about what happened on the way down there that does make sense when you figure it out without trying to pin some giant conspiracy on the leaders in Salt Lake. Now the question then comes up, well, did the leaders in Salt Lake, even if they didn't order this, did they set the stage for it with some of their preaching and some of their belligerence? And I don't think there's any question about that this whole siege mentality that was set up there in 57 with the army on its way certainly contributed to the paranoia and the war hysteria. I mean, there were the folks down there scared that maybe the army wasn't coming down Echo Canyon. It was going to come down the old Spanish Trail and would dump out right there in Iron County instead and then attack Salt Lake from the south. And there was all kinds of that hysteria taking place. And so, you know, I mean, you can say, this could have been handled a whole lot better by a whole lot of people, including the leaders in Salt Lake.
It's
a complicated. And now the other thing, and this is important, Tom. I'm telling this story way too long, but
no problem.
Rick Turley, who's the assistant church historian, now is spending most of his time with church money, and he's hiring folks to help him writing a book about the cover-up. And the cover-up of the massacre, as you and I talked about earlier, was pretty shameful, and the church engaged in it for more than a century. And so the fact that there was a cover-up and the fact that there's blame to go around, including right at the top, nobody's disputing that anymore.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think there's actually more guilt to be had with the cover-up than
the initial setup.
I just wanted to ask a question in regards to Will Bagley's theories, because I've read his book. The Parley P. Pratt assassination. In your own opinion, how much do you think that was a factor? Do you think it was a factor at all or not?
I don't think it was a factor at all, except that there's no doubt that the folks in Iron County had heard about it. I don't buy Will's thesis at all. Now, in fact, I read that book for the University of Oklahoma Press, and I recommended publication before it, you know, came out, because Will did a prodigious amount of research. Unfortunately, he didn't have access to everything that these three Mormons had, and so there's a lot of things that he didn't know about when he was doing his writing. And Will had already committed to his patron that he was going to pin it on Brigham Young. He was convinced Brigham Young was responsible. I don't think the Pratt murder had any more to do with it than to cause the folks there and elsewhere in Utah to feel this sense of foreboding. Well, here we've got another one of our leaders has been murdered, and we've got this army on the way out here, and we're under siege, and we don't know how this all going to turn out. I mean, one trouble with history, Tom, and you know this, is that we always tend to look back on the past in terms of how it turned out. We know how it turned out. Nobody living in the past said, you know, gee, I'm living in the past. they didn't know how it's all going to work out. And so I don't want to be the judge of people who were living in Utah in 1857, either in Iron County or in Salt Lake County or place else, in terms of how afraid they were, although I can guess it was pretty terrifying. And I think the murder of Pratt played a big part in that. And everybody, of course, in Utah knew about that by the time the high summer came, that he'd been killed out there. But this caused these people to be marked for murder. I don't think that makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah, that's my own personal view of it.
Okay, thank you for your insight there. So let's move to some of the people that were involved, some of the local people down there, like John D. Lee. We have, like you mentioned, Isaac Haight, William Dame. I know there's a few other names like John Higbee, Philip Klingensmith.
Yes.
We know
Plainton Smith was the bishop at Cedar. Higbee was the highest-ranking militia person on the scene when it was done. Dane was the stake president at Parowan and also the commander of the Nauvoo Legion in Iron County. Haight, of course, the stake president there at Cedar. Lee, who, of course, became the scapegoat, was executed 20 years later, the only person to be punished for the crime other than excommunications. There are a bunch of them were excommunicated by the Mormon Church. But Lee was somebody who took a lead role early on in the episode by going out to get the Paiutes riled up at the beginning of it. You mentioned probably the principal characters on the murderer's side, but there are 50 or maybe as many as 60 other men who were complicit in the whole thing once it got underway late that week.
Some of the names we don't actually know. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're not really sure. I think the latest book by these three Mormon scholars meticulously has an appendix and meticulously lists everybody who was involved, but with some doubt about, we're not sure about a few others who may have been involved.
Yeah.
But they've done enough research that you can say, gee, my ancestor was down there, and look up in this appendix and see exactly what he was doing out there that day. You know, the trouble with something like this is, Tom, that first of all, they swore a blood oath not to talk about it, but that didn't work. I mean, it was pretty apparent to their families and lots of other people pretty soon after that they had been involved in this bloody thing. And
that's a strong guilt thing even for that.
Sure. But then you start, when you finally do break the silence, if you do, and some did, you're going to want to put yourself in the best light. So a lot of them said, well, you know, I was out there, but I just was riding picket. I didn't do anything. And who knows? Maybe they really believe that. Maybe there were some guys out there that day who shot a child and 15 or 20 or 30 years later had wiped that memory completely out of his mind. I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I know that's easy to do when you've done something really horrible. It's easy to convince yourself, well, I really didn't do that, did I? So it's complicated that way.
Yeah.
We need to mention Juanita Brooks before we forget. This very courageous Southern Utah granddaughter of one of the people out there, Dudley Levitt, who decided in the 30s to blow the whistle on this story. And what a great hero she was. And under the Federal Writers Project, produced this story, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, published by Stanford University in 1950. Juanita, an untrained historian, but a very fine writer and somebody who just, you know, wanted this story out. Her husband was the sheriff there in St. George and not supportive, and the church fathers there and her neighbors and all persecuted her for it and et cetera. But played a major role right there in the middle of the 20th century in getting this story out of the background. And people talked to her. She actually talked with old men who had been out there.
Without her, I don't think we would be anywhere near we are with the knowledge.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, it's pretty hard to believe that 150 years could go by and we wouldn't know a whole lot more than we knew in 1945 or 49. But certainly, Juanita, with her courageous work, you know, you look at her book now, and I read it a second time just right after I read the Walker Turley Leonard book. I read Juanita's a second time to kind of see how they matched up, and she didn't have the tools or the resources available to do anywhere close to the thorough job that those guys did, or even somebody like Bagley did, or Denton did. But nevertheless, it's an incredible bit of work, and broke the ground, and she accepted whole cloth lots of the things that people said, like, well, they were coming down there, and some guy rode through town with a pistol and said, this is the pistol that killed old Joe Smith, and there's another bullet here for Brigham, and those kinds of stories that people used in the aftermath to justify the event. We now doubt most of those stories because we don't have contemporary records. We don't have somebody who said in his diary, oh, yeah, the day a party went through, and guy went through with his pistol. So even with that, you read Juanita's book here 60 years later, and it's an amazing achievement. And talk about courage.
Well, yeah. I mean, think about it. She didn't have the internet. She didn't have the money, and she was doing it in the face of severe hostility against the church that she was a member of, and she did it all on her own. And her book, like you said, that was the first book that I read. And a lot of times when people ask me what book should I read about it, and I usually say, well, start with Juanita Brooks.
Start there. Yeah, I tell people the same thing. Start there.
Because she really is a hero in my book. But.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And I met her when she was an older person, and she in her declining years, I don't know whether she had Alzheimer or whether it was just dementia, but she kind of became like that. But I met her before that had set in, and she was still doing remarkable things. She did a book on Emily, one of John Dee's wives who ran the ferry there for a few years, and did some other really fine work. So we remember her for the Mountain Meadows Massacre book, but she remained a very fine scholar and continued to be committed to trying to tell as much of the story of Southern Utah as she could. And not only things related to massacre, but other kinds of subjects as well.
I agree. Okay, so let's kind of get to the heart of the matter, I guess, with this whole thing. Brigham Young's involvement. Now, I know you've mentioned that you and actually a lot of historians are very skeptical about Brigham Young's initial involvement prior to the massacre, but it's pretty close to unanimous that he was directly involved with the cover-up after the fact.
No doubt. No doubt about that. I don't know anyone from the top in the church history thing. I mean, Marlon Jensen knows that as well as anybody. I think President Hinckley, who tried to inaugurate some of this openness, knew that as well as anybody. Yeah, there was a concerted cover-up. Young believed that if the facts of this ever got out, that it would destroy the church, and it might have had it not been for the Civil War. I mean, people forget that. The shockwaves of this were just beginning to grow to a point where there might have been some huge federal investigation. There could have been all kinds of repercussions when the events in the East began to disintegrate rapidly into the Civil War. And so it wasn't until after the Civil War, we get into the late 60s and the early 70s, that folks in Arkansas and federal officials here in Utah began to press for some kind of investigation. And at that point, the cat's out of the bag, and the church excommunicated all the people you mentioned, even before there were any prosecutions. And the feds were trying to catch all of these guys, and only they settled on Lee for a lot of reasons. He was an easy target. He was somebody that was kind of a tough guy to like for some. And if you talk to members of the Lee family today, they get a little bristly when you say that, but it's true. He was and you can look at his bad or good about him, but he was somebody who didn't mess around. He was tough and had opinions, and it made it so a lot of people were willing to say, well, that Lee, we can see him go down. They were hoping to pin it on Brigham. Were never able to do that, and right up to the moment of his execution, Lee refused to pin it on Young. There has been suggestion that there is evidence that he did. For example, in his confessions called the Mormonism Unveiled, Lee supposedly said, and it's in the book, but he said, it was ordered by Brigham Young through George Smith. Well, historians are pretty convinced the latter part of that book was put together by his attorney who had been given the manuscript as his payment. We have his journal accounts where he repeatedly denied that Young had anything to do with it, didn't know about it until I told him about it, and so on. But certainly the cover-up, there's no question about that. There's no debate about that whatsoever. It was concerted. It was undertaken with great vigor by the church because Young was convinced that this could just really bring down the whole mess, could come falling down. Because of what these Mormons had done.
You know, talking about the cover-up, you know, the cover-up is actually one of the things that doesn't sit with me very well at all.
I understand.
And you know, when you were mentioned that Richard Turley is doing the follow-up to their first book. So
it's going to be a blunt. I talked with Rick here, 6 months ago. I kind of trying to keep up with where it is, and I said, you know, I said, are you going to pull your punches? I mean, I really asked him directly. He said, nope, this is going to be full out, no punches pulled. Description of the cover-up.
Well, he has. Yeah, I don't. I don't wish I was him having to write about that.
No, that's going to be tough.
But
and here he is, the assistant church historian, and doing this under the auspices of the church. And some are going to say, well, that makes it suspicious because how can we trust him? But I think when this book comes out, just like the one these three did on the massacre, you're going to see that they're not trying to hide anything. Nobody comes away unspotted in this book they did on the massacre. Nobody.
I agree. So let's also there's also a moment in the massacre that I want to talk about that for some reason doesn't sit well with me either, that Will Bagley talks about, and actually I think all of them talk about a little bit, is the monument that was put up by Major Carleton in 1859.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they got there and all the bodies were just strung out, and it was them that dug a mass grave. Is that correct? And then put up a monument.
Well, not to take too much time on this, Tom, but it's kind of a long story. That one of the things that doesn't sit well with me, and I have to tell you, with my students and the people in Arkansas either, is that once the deed was done, they didn't take much time trying to bury the bodies. I mean, they drug them off into some ravines, kicked a little dirt and some brush on them.
Yeah, it kind of is.
They wanted to get the heck out of there. And so, yeah, it's true that the bodies were strewn all over the place and animals drug them around. And
it's like insult to injury to something that's already...
It doesn't sit well with anybody. I mean, that's just... And the only excuse for it is they were... it's not an excuse, but I mean, the only way you can try to understand this, these guys were just horrified at what they had just done under this sense of panic and duty or whatever it was operating in their minds. And so they didn't want, and most of those guys that we know anything about later never went back out there, never went back out to the meadows, ever. They wouldn't go out there if you held a gun to their heads. And so it's not an excuse, but it helps you understand a little bit why they did that. Well, anyway, the end of the story, of course, as you point out, is that the army comes there in May of 1859. We're looking at a year and a half later, more. And they find stuff all over. I mean, these bones that we dug up down there in 99 had gnaw marks on them from critters, coyotes, gnawed on them and drug them around and so on. And so the army gathers them out and buried them in 3-4 mass graves. And the biggest, most noted, not maybe the biggest, but the most noted grave was at the side of the wagon circle where the Arkansans had dug a rifle pit, and they buried partial remains of 34 victims there. And Carleton identified the number by counting the shoulder blades of the remains. So there was cranial matter, there were long bones, there was vertebrate matter and ribs and all this stuff, and they apparently we know now by what we accidentally discovered while we were digging for the new monument that he buried the remains in categories. He didn't try to create 34 separate bodies. He buried the cranial matter at one end, the ribs, the vertebrate matter, the long bones, and so on in that rifle pit, and then erected this way time they erected this big stone cairn over the top of it and put a sign on it that said, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." And, of course, Carleton knew, and anybody by that time who had looked into it all knew that this had been done by these local settlers. So over the years, that monument was torn down. It was rebuilt. It was torn down. It was rebuilt. Bagley, Will loves to make a big thing out of the visit to the site by Brigham Young where he either watched, or it depends on who you read, or ordered the sign taken down and said, "Yes, vengeance is mine, and I have taken some." And this of course becomes kind of a centerpiece of Will Bagley's thesis, that here Brigham Young was admitting other scholars look at that and say, look, he's trying to shore up these people. He's trying to shore everybody up for the cover-up and for this solid front against blaming anybody for this, except that something terrible happened here, and I'm not going to feel too bad about it because these are our enemies anyway, and he's kind of making that sort of subconscious rhetoric. So anyway, it makes a big thing out of that, and that that cairn was torn down, rebuilt. Finally, in 1932, the Utah Trails Association, under the leadership of Mormon Apostle George Albert Smith, went down there and rebuilt the cairn a little bit. It's not nearly as big, and tried to kind of cement it into something permanent with a little rock wall around it. The trouble is the Mogatsu Creek going right by it was eroding down and down and down, and part of that monument was sloughing off into the gulch. Well, President Hinckley goes up there in 98 and sees that mess and finds out that it's on church property because the guy who owned that piece of ground didn't want it, tried to give it to some people in Arkansas, they didn't want it, so he gave it to the church. And so the irony there of the church owning that gravesite. Well, anyway, that's when Hinckley said, well, we've got to rebuild that, the church will rebuild that, and got the Mountain Meadows Association involved in that, and the board met with Hinckley in October 98, and he said, I want to get this thing fixed. And so we built this big new monument down there. Tried to rebuild the cairn and cement it in place, and they put a big sort of sandstone wall around it, a fence and all.
Yeah.
And at that time, the church, which had never been willing before, said, yeah, and we can put interpretive markers there that pin it on the militiamen. Instead of having it be vaguely, well, a bunch of people died here, and we don't know what happened to them, and maybe the Indians did it, and who knows, and so on, which had been what the case had been before. And so we now have interpretive markers there explaining in a few paragraphs what you and I have been talking about here all night, to say that this was the Mormons and some Indians whom they had cajoled into doing this, where we've long since tried to get people to stop saying, oh, it was the Indians who did it, or the Indians and they persuaded the Mormons. It's the other way around. I mean, the Indians were brought in as some muscle for this whole thing that was planned and executed by the Nauvoo Legion.
That really is one of the saddest things, is the Indians, those local Paiute Indians, have had a serious cross to bear with all this, haven't they?
Yeah, they got hammered. And what's happened now, ironically, Tom, is that they now deny that the tribal position is officially that there were no Paiutes involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Oh.
In 1990, they got up with the church and state and people and sort of took responsibility. The tribal leader was an old guy, Kasim, can't think of his name. He since passed, and in 99, when they did the new monument, just 9 years later, the new tribal chairperson, who's a woman, can't think of her name either, embarrassingly, I can see her face, said, oh, no, we weren't involved at all. So they're in denial about being involved in any way, shape, or form, and have some. This book by Forrest Kutch, governor's Native American guy, accepted whole cloth that they were just kind of sitting around up on the hills watching it, and the Mormons were all dressed up like Indians, and they didn't have anything to do with it. But that being said, I don't know anybody now, including these Mormon scholars who did this book, who are going to argue that the Indians are blamed for it. They weren't blamed for it. They were drug into it by the local folks, white folks.
Yeah. So I kind of want to talk about John D. Lee. You say he was the scapegoat, and most historians I know put that he was kind of the scapegoat in it.
Sure.
And a lot of, I know that a lot of descendants and even a lot of people in general look at John D. Lee. One person was solely responsible for that whole thing, and it's kind of a travesty. What are some of your thoughts? Because I know John D. Lee is also one of the most colorful characters in Utah's past as well.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of your thoughts about that?
There's no doubt that he is not the only guilty person, and certainly may not even be the most guilty person if you want to assign guilt for this horrible thing. that he paid the only ultimate price for it is certainly shameful. And I don't know anybody now, honestly, who thinks otherwise. Was he innocent? The answer is no, he was not. I mean, he confessed. It is two trials that he executed some people and murdered some people. And so he was certainly guilty, and he may have been more active early in that week than anybody else in causing the problem to unfold out on the scene. But certainly ended up taking the brunt of the prosecution. He was convicted, by the way, in his second trial by an all-Mormon jury. He was convinced that that he was going to be rescued that by that jury, but they convicted him. His first trial was a half-Mormon, half-Gentile jury that that was hung. So he was convinced if he had an all-Mormon jury, he was going to get off. But by that time, Brigham Young and others are thinking, look, if we can just give him Lee, maybe they'll leave the rest of these guys alone. And so I don't know. I think you could argue pretty clearly that he was a sacrificial. I mean, people say scapegoat. If you look at the biblical meaning of the term scapegoat, maybe a better term is a sacrificial lamb.
Yeah,
than
maybe.
A scapegoat. Yeah.
What do you think
and,
about?
You know, the Lee people, there's quite a division in the Lee family. I mean, you may know that Rex Lee, who was president of BYU and so on, Solicitor General of the United States, great-grandson of John D. Lee, Stuart Udall, great-grandson of John D. Lee. There have been some very prominent folks who descend from Lee, and some
sure.
are devoted Mormons, some are not-so-devoted Mormons. Some Lee descendants have changed the spelling of their last name because they're ashamed either of their ancestor or they don't want to be associated with his infamy. Some of the Lee descendants spell it L-E-I-G-H. But I've met lots and lots of Lee descendants who are devoted Mormons, who feel terrible about what happened to their ancestor. Their objective is to try to get people to stop thinking of him as, you mentioned, the only guilty party. They recognize the guilt of their ancestor, but they certainly don't want people thinking that, gosh, he's the only one punished, so he must have been the only real bad guy in this story. Lots of bad guys in this story.
Yeah. So I know, I've actually read a lot about Lee's family. It's a pretty big, and it's like you said, pretty big and prominent family. I know they even, isn't it true, in the 60s, early 60s, 1960s, some of the Lee's family actually petitioned the church to...
Yes. David O. McKay agreed to restore Lee's blessings. And at that time, the blessings of some of these other guys were similarly restored, but it was the Lee family that got that done. I forget the date. You're right, it was in the 60s. It was during the latter part of David O. McKay's administration.
I know, if I remember right, I think Juanita Brooks actually mentions that in her book.
She does. She does. In a later edition. Like I say, there are an awful lot of the Lees. I've met, gosh, dozens of them over the years now, and many of them are just really devoted Mormons, and others not so devoted Mormons.
True.
It's a very big family. He had a number of wives, as you know, and there are lots of his descendants about.
I know that must have been, if I remember right, when I reading in Juanita Brooks's book, that was quite the controversial thing. The church reapproving John D. Lee's temple
was
to be done. That,
yes, it's very controversial.
Even to me today, thinking about that, that does kind of put a bad taste in your mouth a little bit.
Well, it could, but if you were a Lee, it might not.
True, very true.
And the other thing you have to remember, Tom, is when you study history, whether it's religious history or any other kind of history, in this case, it is and it isn't. It's militia history, it's state history, it's all kinds of things. But when you study history, it's pretty hard for us to sit here in our comfortable setting and look back at Iron County in 1857.
Yeah, hindsight's
always. And I'm not making excuses for these guys. I've been accused of that in the past. And even when I've been in some conversations with Arkansas folks, and they'll say, well, are you trying to get these guys off the hook? And the answer is, I'm not trying to get anybody off the hook. I'm just saying it may give you and me a giant pain in the ribs to think about some of this stuff. But I wasn't there. And I often ask my students, as we're wrestling with this stuff, and some of them are in pain, and I'll say, could you do something like this? And right away you'll see them shaking their heads. No, I couldn't do something like this. The answer is anybody could do something like this. You get the right circumstances in place, and anybody would do something like this.
You know, I imagine you're right. I imagine if we could go back in time.
No doubt about it.
I mean, you say 50 perpetrators were involved.
Something like that, yeah.
I mean, I imagine if you could probably take any of them at random back in the day and say, you know, you're obviously a religious person. Do you find yourself capable of committing cold-blooded murder? They'd probably say no.
No. Other than the, I think it's important to note this, and I think I said this a little bit before, but it's important to note that there's a culture of violence in the West in those days. Mike Quinn has done quite a bit of good work on the culture of violence it was about, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre is certainly a horrific, maybe there's none more horrific in the history of the West, unless you start talking about massacres of Native Americans like Sand Creek and in 64 and up here at Bear River in 63 and stuff like that. But when you think about white Americans murdering other white Americans, that is maybe nothing even close. But as you look around the West in that time, there was a lot of talk about violence. There was a lot of violence being undertaken, a lot of people being murdered in the name of justice, people being having revenge brought on them. Vigilantes of Montana in the 1870s, I mean, horrific killings there. You look at the Osawatomie Massacre by John Brown that happened out in Kansas in the early 50s. So it's not exactly an isolated incident. It may be the most horrific, but it's not an isolated incident. A lot of people were thinking about violence. A lot of people were thinking violent solutions were perhaps not only all right, but maybe the only possible direction to take in certain circumstances. Once again, let me underline this. I'm not making excuses for anybody, but I am suggesting that as historians, we have to be real careful to sit here in 2010 in our circumstances and say, well, look at these rotten buggers and what these rotten guys did. You know, we got to be real careful about that. And
true.
You look at all kinds of these things, like the My Lai Massacre. People have wanted to, a couple of people wanted to make comparison between the My Lai Massacre and the Mountain Meadows Massacre in Vietnam. And what we found out, and I've done a lot of reading on that. I'm a vet myself, and I've done a lot of reading on that. And I don't know. Would I have shot those people, given the circumstances of what had happened in that area in Nam before that occurred? I don't know. I hope not.
Yeah.
I hope I would have been one of the guys standing over there saying, wow, this is terrible. You know, Kelly, you can't do this. And the other guys, what are you doing? But I don't know.
Really, really hard to know. That's a tough job for historians. I don't envy you there. But
well, except that we're trained, Tom, and I think it's important, and it's important for people who aren't trained to be the way we are, and maybe it's not all good, but except that we're trained to look at these kinds of things with a bit of coldness, and I don't know if that's the right word, but we're supposed to take a look from a distance and say, okay, let's be careful about making judgment calls. Let's be careful about using adjectives. Let's be careful about assessing somebody's evil intent. Evil done often in the past by people without evil intent doesn't excuse it, but it's still the case.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to mention an event in more recent history that actually meant a lot to me personally. It was on September 11, 2007. It was the 150-year anniversary. Were you there? Were you there by chance?
I was.
I read it, and I've actually watched the clip, or some of the clips that of some of the speakers that were at that event. If it's all right with you, I want to play just a quick minute clip of President Eyring talking real quick, and then we'll comment after that.
Sure. What was done here long ago by members of our church represents a terrible and inexcusable departure from Christian teaching and conduct. We cannot change what happened, but we can remember and honor those who were killed here. We express profound regret for the massacre carried out in this valley 150 years ago today, and for the undue and untold suffering experienced by the victims then and by their relatives to the present time. A separate expression of regret is owed to the Paiute people, who have unjustly borne for too long the principal blame for what occurred during the massacre. Although the extent of their involvement is disputed, it is believed that they would not have participated without the direction and stimulus provided by local church leaders and members. We know, too, that many of those who carried out the massacre were haunted all their lives by what they did and saw on that unforgettable day.
You know, Gene, when that happened, you know, I was kind of in the middle of my own crisis of trying to compartmentalize this event that I'd been studying and getting a little obsessed with. And it just seemed ironic that, you know, it was the 150th year anniversary and that happened. And then I got to actually listen to President Eyring, who was an apostle at the time, say those words. It actually brought me to tears. What are some of your thoughts?
Well, it brought me to tears too. And when I hadn't heard that since he said those words, I heard him say them. But when he said them, and when I just listened to them now, it reminds me of the meeting we had with President Hinckley at 47 East South Temple on in late October 8, 1998. When he met with us, the board, and said words almost exactly like those. Not as detailed, but one of the descendants of John Baker, who was one of the captains of the party, he left most of his family in Arkansas, so he has lots of descendants, unlike the Fanchers and others who, of course, were killed there. But anyway, Don Baker from California, this kind of hard-bitten Arkansas guy with an accent and colorful language, we'll tell you today that he was moved to tears by President Hinckley saying the same words, and that it was good enough for him. Now, unfortunately, by the time we got down to the monument dedication in 99, the church attorneys or somebody had said to President Hinckley, don't be that regretful, and had him more worried about expressing that much regret. And so the Hinckley speech at the dedication of the Carlton rebuilt cairn there on September 11, 1999, stopped short of being as regretful as President Eyring was. But in our meeting with him at the board, he was just that regretful. So, when I heard President Eyring say that, and I've also heard other church people, Dennis Neuenswander, who was there in 99 as the church, helping us with the church on the day before we had the funeral, I've said words like those. I've heard Marlon Jensen say words like those. And earlier in our discussion, I mentioned how the victims' people have a much better feeling now toward the church than they have ever had. And it's partly because of these statements of regret. And again, I think this President Eyring, I'm not saying had not, his remarks did not suggest that the church had come a long way even since 1999, because it had. But that's where it is now. I don't hear church leaders making the kinds of excuses they used to about this.
You know, I have to admit that it is a fine line to walk for them, because they don't want to admit full responsibility for it, but yet their heart breaks because there were church members and church leaders involved. So.
Sure. And the other thing that I think is so important here, Tom, and again, maybe some of your listeners will construe this as me trying to make some sort of excuse, but you have to remember that this was all done under militia command. Now, in Utah, the guys running the town, the guys running the militia, and the guys running the church were the same guys. It was a theocracy. But there was still Major John Higbee ordering Major John D. Lee to do this and that, and it was Colonel William Dame in charge of all this. And it doesn't take very long to look around the history of the United States and find these kinds of militia units, a bunch of untrained, poorly disciplined, quasi-military guys under the old militia tradition in the United States doing all kinds of stupid things and committing all kinds of ugly atrocities. And I hesitate in bringing this up because a lot of apologists for the Mount Meadows Massacre will bring up the Hans Mill Massacre. But at Hans Mill in Missouri, not so many years before, it was the Missouri militia that had come into that town and slaughtered a bunch of innocents in the name of the state militia. So there are a lot of ways to look at this. None of it makes it taste any better. But I think we have people out there who want to see this from a one-dimensional perspective. And as historians, we're not allowed to do that. We got to take a look at it from all the angles and say, this is a complicated, complex tragedy, atrocity, use whatever nasty word you can think of. But we got to think about it from a lot of different perspectives in order to understand it very well. I don't think it helps much to say, oh, here's the Mount Meadows Massacre. This proves that Brigham Young was a bad person. Or here's the Mount Meadows Massacre proves that religion is bad. This was Krakauer's thesis, of course. Yeah. It's not just Mormonism, but religion in general. Look at all the millions of people who have been slaughtered in the name of God. I mean, look at 9-11. I mean, 9-11, same day, but recently,
yeah.
All in the name of God. And so I don't think it helps to think that way. I think it does help us to understand how religion can play a part in all this. Did the teachings of blood atonement, did the blood oaths that people were taking, and it was the sense of isolation and anger that the Mormons were feeling here in Utah in the 1850s, was this all partly responsible? No doubt about it. But it's complicated. It's deeply complicated. And so I think we have to be pretty careful with this story. It's as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, it's never going to go away. There's no definitive answers for everything. And nobody's ever going to say, oh, well, I read that book and now I have all the answers. Nobody with a good bit of sense will say that. But there are a whole lot of people running around who've read Will Bagley's book or who've read Sally Denton's book or Krakauer's book or even this book by these three Mormon guys and say, well, now I know. That's far beyond the humility of good historians and people who want to understand history.
Yeah, I've read as many books as I can get my hands on, sure. And I've stayed away from Sally Denton's book primarily because what you recommended prior to this. But
I think Sally missed the boat entirely. I have a lot of respect for Will's book. Again, I recommended it to the University of Oklahoma Press to be published because of the prodigious research he did. I don't agree with his thesis. I've been pretty outspoken about that. I think that Turley and Walker and Leonard have got it at about 99%. I'm convinced. I'm persuaded. When you look at a book that's one-fourth of the book is footnotes, and you know those are accurately being perused and scrutinized,
yeah.
You're going to have to put some credence in what those guys have put together there. But, yeah, I don't recommend Sally Denton's book being of much use.
Yeah, when I read the Turley Walker Leonard book, it ended right where I knew that a lot of the big stuff, and I'm really anxious to, I guess I'm anxious to read it. I'll be one of the first ones to buy it.
Yeah.
But I'll have to make sure I'm not reading it on a full stomach at the same time. But
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
But I do want to before we let you go, I want to hear what you know some of your recommendations for guys like me. How you know what kind of advice you'd give for a person that finds this kind of event terribly distressing.
Well, I think there are two or three ways to deal with it. And I've talked with a whole lot of folks over the years who've had your experience and others. And I might have been persuasive to some and much less for others, like I mentioned my best friend earlier. One thing I think we need to remember is that, and I've already made this point, but let me make it again more briefly. This is a complicated event. It's so complicated that we will have always a difficult time answering the question, how could it have happened? How could these ordinarily decent human beings, and I think they were, do such an absolutely atrocious thing to their fellow human beings, children, helpless innocents. It's just so complicated that I think the first thing you have to do is say, I can't make any final judgments about anything based on this due to the complexity of it. The second thing I think is important, that people will say, well, if Brigham Young bears any guilt in this whatsoever, I don't care whether it's indirect or complicity or the cover-up or anything like this, then that proves the guy was not a prophet. Well, if you're going to have any faith in religion at all, and I mean the next step has to be, well, you just become an atheist, because there's not a religion on the planet, including the religion of the Jews in the Old Testament, where leaders didn't order and were not complicit in these same kinds of things. I mean, Ezekiel ordered the Hebrews to slaughter every man, woman, maiden, dog, pig, everything.
You're right about that.
Yeah, so does that mean that this guy was not a prophet? Well, I don't know. If you read the Old Testament and you're a believer in the Bible, you'd have to say, well, no, that doesn't mean that at all. So I think the second thing is, let's withhold our judgment on whether or not somebody is a prophet or a holy person or whatever like that based on these kinds of events, because you're going to be hard-pressed to find any religious leader or any group of religious leaders where you don't have this sort of story. And I think the third thing that's important about this is Mormonism suffers from the problem of being a new religion. People, we have more access to the whole history of Mormonism than the Catholics have to their whole history, because it's their history is however many hundreds or thousands of years old. We're intimate with everything that has happened in the past 160, 70 years. So you can pick at the scabs on Joseph Smith, and you can pick at the scabs on Brigham Young, and you can pick at all this kind of stuff, and come to the conclusion, well, there's no evidence here that this is a clean, righteous story of clean, righteous men who do only clean, righteous things. I think we ask too much of human beings when we expect that sort of behavior. So I think that's part of what I'd said to you earlier about trying to assess blame and trying to assess guilt for these people in Iron County, or if you wish, even for Brigham Young and his associates as being responsible for this horrible thing. It's too complicated for that. So I don't know. I think the way to deal with it, if you're a Mormon and you're stumbling onto the Mount Meadows Massacre and you're thinking, gosh, this shakes my faith, you have to remember what the definition of faith is. It's something that you don't know. It's something you feel. Paul's definition, we're all familiar with it. So we're not going to find verification for Brigham Young's divine calling as a prophet in the good things he did or in the bad things he did. You're going to find that in what's in your heart. And if it's not in your heart, then certainly these kinds of historical events can shake you up and make you think that there was never much to it anyway. And as you mentioned, I mentioned to you, people have walked out the back door of the church over this. I'm not sure that's a good idea. I think you need to decide that based on other kinds of issues and not on these sorts of historical questions.
Well, you give good advice. And
well, I hope so.
And I am immensely grateful for you just spending a little bit of time and sharing your immense knowledge and your experience with us, and especially with me. It really means a lot that you were willing to come on with us tonight, so I appreciate that.
Well, I hope it's been helpful, Tom. I don't claim to be the expert on this event. I'm not. There are people who know a lot more about it than I do, and I hope I didn't come across tonight as pontificating in any way, shape, or form about it. But I have, like you, I've spent a lot more years than you have, because I started doing work on the massacre about the time you were being born. And I've worried about this a long time, and I've suffered with it a lot. I've shed a lot of tears. That summer of 99, when I was involved on the ground down there as we dug up those bones and as we had all those experiences, I've had my share of deep emotion about it as well. But as we conclude, I can just tell you it hasn't affected one way or the other how I feel about Mormonism. That comes from someplace else for me, and I'm not in a position to have this story or any other story in our history influence me on that side of my life, because I don't make my decisions on that side of my life based on this kind of stuff.
Well, thank you. And I do strongly disagree. I do think that you are an expert in this. And
Well, you're kind. I think I'm probably a little well versed than 90% or 99% of Mormons or even historians on it, because I spent so much time with it. But I have a whole lot I don't know. I'm humbled when I sit down with Rick Turley and some of these guys. I mean, I have a student who came to me the other day and he said, you know, my brother happened to be in a meeting with Rick Turley, and Turley looked at his name tag and said, oh, there's a guy with your name who was involved in the massacre. And it turned out it was an incidental person who was traveling with another company that showed up once in the book.
Oh.
And Turley was able to tell this guy all about his ancestor, where he came from, how he was involved in the Duke Party, and that he was a sheriff in Arkansas. This guy had no idea about his ancestor, and Rick Turley, off the top of his head, filled him in on his whole family history. So that's how deeply these guys have investigated this story. I don't know anywhere close to what those guys know.
True.
And you know, somebody like Will Bagg, don't agree with Will about much in terms of his thesis, but he sure knows a lot more than I do, and he's just taken a different tack on what it all means. So, I don't mean to sound falsely humble either. This is something I've wrestled with a whole long time, and I'm comfortable talking about it, but don't want anybody to think, the guy thinks he knows it. No, because I don't.
But honestly, and this is genuine from me, I truly admire the fact that you are willing to become a part of the Mountain Meadows Association, to meet with some of the descendants, and to develop strong friendships. I think that says a lot.
Well, I'm that kind of guy anyway, and I like people, and I like to have people like me, and so it's been wonderful over the years to get to know some of these people, and I won't tell you that all of them like me that much. I mean, I had to bat heads with a few of them, but I do have some really deep affections for some of these people, and when we see each other, it literally is hug and shed tears about we haven't seen you for too long kind of a thing.
Great.
That's neat.
Well, again, thank you, Professor Gene Sessions, for coming on the show with us.
Well, thank you, Tom. Hope it does some good for somebody who wants to know more and who may be wrestling with this.